I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Ed Willis joins me now. He's just published a great read, Never Boring, The Up and Down History of the Vancouver Canucks. He takes the reader beginning in the 1960s, when Vancouver, desperate for an NHL franchise, is left out thanks to the various machinations of people here and elsewhere, Central Canada specifically. It might be a conspiracy of sorts or not. The book looks at the various ownership groups over the last 54 years, from those early days in the 1970s through to the Frank Griffiths era, McCaw, and now the Aquilinis. We see the challenges of owning an NHL franchise and how the owners are regarded by fan and foe alike. We are regaled with stories of unforgettable players, characters through the highs and lows of wins and losses, players who dazzle fans with skill or personality or both. As Mr. Willis tells me in this interview we taped a couple of weeks ago, this book from Harbor Publishing was to have come out last fall, but because of a delay turned fortuitous. The book is out now with a hell of a last chapter. He narrates just how the Canucks seem to have gotten out of that funk from the time of the management of Jim Benning through to the coaching of Bruce Boudreau through today's management group of Jim Rutherford, Patrick Alvin, and award-winning head coach Rick Tocchet. The excitement surrounding the team during that playoff run comes through the page, and it either bodes well for the season ahead or perhaps signifies an aberration. I'll ask Ed about all that and more. The book is also a great tribute to daily sports journalism. We see once more glimpses of the writing of Jim Kearney, Jim Coleman, Jim Taylor, and even Alan Fotheringham, among many others. There's also a lot of Mr. Willis's own work, as he spent some 40 years covering sports at newspapers across Canada, including many years at the province here in Vancouver. Ed Willis is also the author of The Rebel League, Gretzky to Lemieux, and End Zones and Border Wars. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Ed Willis. Mr. Willis, good morning.
Morning, Joe. How are you doing?
Pretty good yourself.
Yeah, great. It's a great day, lovely day here in North Van.
And we're taping this on Tuesday the 24th, and I guess the first preseason game is tonight. Mm-hmm. How do you watch these games now that you're not in the daily news business?
Yeah, now that the meter isn't running. Honestly, I have difficulty working up that same level of engagement, obviously. But it's just, you know, I kind of watch it. It's almost like academic, like you're kind of detached and you go, oh, that's kind of interesting, and you know, you recognize trends and you know what the story will be that night, but it's just not the same you know, it's when I was doing it for a living.
But last season was pretty good, wasn't it?
Last year was it was really, really interesting on so many levels for me. I'll tell you a quick story. I'll walk you through the genesis of the book. It was originally written for a fall of 23 release, and the publishers, Harbor, over on the Sunshine Coast, decided they were going to push it back to the fall of 24. So I finished it sometime in August of 23, and then the Canucks go on this amazing season that nobody really saw coming. I think people were probably expecting them to be competitive, but nobody mm-hmm. was expecting them to have the best record in the NHL for three quarters of the season. You know, and then have this like mini run in the playoffs where, you know, they push Edmonton right to the brink. So I had to do a lot of rewriting. I had to remove a lot of snark. I had to change the tone in a lot of places. But I think it's a better book now, and I think it's more representative of the history of the Canucks, Joe. You know, there's been obviously a lot of dark moments, but there's also been these like kind of bright, shimmering moments that the faithful have clung on to. And, you know, I think that's the trade-off for them. It hasn't always been great, but they have, you know, whether it's 82 or 94 or 2011 or last year, they've had this moment when, you know, their faith was rewarded.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing after reading Never Boring is that these peaks and valleys. And I can understand why people, you know, are fans of the Canucks, and I can understand why they get frustrated with the Canucks and the management, you know, and the coaches and the sort, and you know, it becomes almost routine after, you know, several years that, you know, they start chanting in the arena
yeah.
that this manager be fired or this owner sell the team. When you look back at 54 years of history, as you do in this book, you know, early on, it seems like there were, you know, you don't have to be conspiracy theorists, there were dark forces that were against Vancouver having a franchise. The league itself, it seemed like, was against the Canucks. How does it, when you look back at it all and you see the how it all started, and it seemed inevitable that Vancouver would get a team, but impossible at the same time.
Well, yeah, they took their time doing it, and it's kind of, you know, kind of a fitting metaphor. You know, the birth was every bit as painful as everything that followed. You know, it starts with a story I had never heard or was completely unfamiliar with. Vancouver was supposed to be a shoo-in in the first round of expansion in 1967. Clarence Campbell, who was then the president of the NHL, was saying it publicly. And about 3 years before 67, Stafford Smythe, who was co-owner of the Maple Leafs, tells Jim Kearney, who is the columnist at the Vancouver Sun, that he is willing to build a new arena in Vancouver. Just one small catch: the city has to donate the land, and the land he wanted is basically where the Vancouver Public Library now sits, which is pretty prime real estate. Yeah. So, you know, it became this divisive civic issue. It went to a plebiscite. It was soundly defeated. And Stafford Smythe said, Vancouver's a bush league town, and there won't be NHL hockey in this city for a generation. Now, this is an era when there's basically 2, 3, 4, 5 people controlled the whole league, and Smythe was one of them. Subsequent events sort of suggested, yeah, he did poison the water, but then the Vancouver bit didn't help itself. Ownership was in disarray. There were two factions kind of competing against each other. And Campbell eventually just threw his hands up and said, that's it, not this time, boys. And then the same thing happened again in 1970. The local ownership groups were infighting, and they were splintered, and they were divided. And that's why the first owner of the Canucks was this dude from Minnesota named Tom Scallon. There was, like, no local ownership until Frank Griffith stepped up in 78 to buy the team. Sorry, 70, I always get this wrong. Not 78. I believe it's 74 he buys the team.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating to see in the book how you cover a lot of those early days through the newspaper columns of there. You mentioned Jim Kearney. Mm-hmm. It must have been fun going back, listening or reading Jim Taylor, even, you know, Alan Fotheringham, Pete McMartin, again. Was that part of the book, writing the book, say, the research fun?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, as a newspaper junkie, I mean, it was so pleasurable for me. And, you know, God bless databases. You can go online and virtually find any paper. So I go back to, I think, 64 is the start, is when Kearney writes that story that the Stafford Smythe's willing to build an arena in Vancouver. And it was just, yeah, it was just so cool revisiting. And a lot of these people now, I knew Jim Taylor, I knew some of them, but most of them were just kind of names to me. But it was just fascinating to see, you know, how they were played in the paper, who were the real stars, who were ahead of the story, who was faking it. Really interesting. Yeah, it was one of the real rewarding parts of doing the research for the book.
I'm curious to know, as I was reading the book, about this relationship between the ownership and the management. Because it does play out over the years that some owners are more, I don't know how to put this, but more active in the management of the team than they should be in the sort. What's the model in over the history of the Canucks? The Pat Quinn, Griffiths era, is that how a team should be run, say?
Yeah, in a perfect world, yeah. But that has to be viewed against the backdrop of the times. That was an era when the local rich guy could own the team, like a guy who had, you know, a couple of car dealerships, or a guy who owned, you know, had, in Griffith's case, a couple of radio stations. You know, he spelled his money with an M for millions, not a B with billions. And Frank Griffiths, you know, he targeted Pat Quinn. He took over, and the franchise was just a mess. It was a disaster. He decided what he was going to do is, you know, hire an Uber boss, you know, this hockey overlord, and he targeted Pat Quinn and eventually got him, but got him in a way that is completely fitting with the Canucks' history. It ends up in court. It's Pat suspended. He can't coach the team for the first 3 years. but he was the right guy. And I think that's true. If you get the right guy in place and give him power, stand back and let him do his job, I think that's the best model. And the Aquilinis, I think, have a lot of things to answer for. But they seem to have the model right now. Whether how long it lasts, we'll have to wait and see. But Jim Rutherford is calling the shots. There's a clear chain of command and an order to it. And Patrick Albin is the general manager. And so far they've pushed all the right buttons. So we'll just see where this thing goes.
I found it interesting to read, you know, during the Jim Benning years, about how active the Aquilini, especially Francesco Aquilini, was involved with the team. I guess, we see now with Rutherford and Elvin, he's sort of, not involved day-to-day, is he?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, but, you know, it's a lot easier for that chain of command to remain in place when the team's winning. And, you know, that's kind of been the problem in the past. Things start to go south and ownership starts to get involved. And they've made some poor decisions that have really set this franchise back. And I think of the Trevor Linden years and what a lost opportunity that was on so many different levels. I'm still convinced he was the right man for the job. But it was the way he was hired. I mean, you know, any other organization, would groom him, would let him, you know, sit and learn that side of the business for 3-4 years the way Colorado did with Joe Sakic, the way Detroit did with Steve Yzerman, the way Boston did with Cam Neely. Trevor just gets thrown to the wolves after a terrible year. He goes out and hires a rookie general manager, and then they hire a rookie head coach. Well, no wonder it didn't work. I still say he was the right man, and you know, when he realized where things were going and wanted to start a comprehensive rebuild, that's when he ran into pushback from ownership, and it eventually cost him his job. Jim Benning was willing to go along with this kind of rebuild on the fly mode, and it didn't work, which is putting it mildly.
Yeah. The book is full of these great what ifs. March 8, 2004. You know, what if Todd Bertuzzi had left the ice earlier. You ask in the book about, you know, the struggle between the Aquilinis and Tom Gilardi and Ryan Beattie. What if Gilardi and Beattie had prevailed in that court case? Contrast the front office, the management situation under Aquilini, and say what happened in Dallas with Tom Gilardi owning that team. There's a great what if there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, the way things played out. Like, the Aquilinis have had some moments. There's no doubt about that. They were running the show in 2011, and that was the best ever Canucks team. They've overseen this restructuring now with Rutherford at the head and Alvin as the general manager. They had, and Trevor, everybody forgets, Trevor's first year was very successful. Team finished, I'm just blanking out. It seemed to me they finished third in the division, but they were over 100 points. And then they got beat in the first round by Calgary, and that was really the only bright spot. So there have been moments, but I just look at what was built in Dallas, and they've had the same general manager for virtually the whole time Gilardi's owned the team. Jim Neal, of course. Same director of scouting, the same president, Jim Leitz, more or less. It's just been like a stable organization. And to me, they're going to win a Stanley Cup here in the next 3-4 years. I would bet on it. But it's just the way they're running, the way things are structured, compared to, you know, everything that's happened at the Canucks since 2004 when the Aquilinis took over the team. It's, you know, I think you can draw your own conclusions there.
The chemistry of the West Coast Express, you chronicle that in a chapter in the book. The line itself, Naslin, Morris, and Bertuzzi, how that comes together, I mean, it's almost by accident, isn't it? But then something strikes, doesn't it? And I guess I'm curious to know, because I'm a casual hockey fan. What role does a coach have in, say, putting something like that together?
Well, I think he does. To me, the extraordinary thing about that West Coast Express is really they were only operating at the peak of their powers for a year and a half. Everybody kind of thinks of this as this, you know, golden moment that stretches from here to there, but they really only put together at the second part of the 2002 season, so they have half that season and the full next season, where they're the best line in hockey. I think most people would concede that. Mark Crawford and Todd Bertuzzi had like epic battles with Mark Crawford. Said he was the right coach. You know, like he pushed them. He and Bertuzzi, oil and water, right? They just did not mix. But he allowed them to play at full throttle. They allowed them, you know, to play a speed and skill game. And this is an era. This is the height of the dead puck era, when there was like boring hockey, almost unwatchable hockey being played all over the NHL. But I maintain there wasn't a better place to watch hockey than GM Place from 2002 to 2004. That line made the game fun, and it was such a bomb for Canucks fan because, you know, as you pointed out, that team kind of materialized out of the blue. It was Brian Burke had taken over after the disaster with Mike Keenan, and he makes a couple of trades, and Naslund out of the blue develops into this elite scorer, an MVP type player. I think that was probably my favorite chapter in the book, because I got a pretty good relationship with all three of those guys, and they were insightful and forthcoming, and really told their story nicely.
Well, when you talk about being insightful and forthcoming, do you think it's the passage of time that players are become that? Or, I mean, you know, you covered the team, you know, on a daily basis. I mean, you were also able to get to talk to them, you know, in an intimate way. Is it really different when they're, say, retired, as they are?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, there's a statute of limitations there, and that opens up a whole window. And the other thing is, these guys are like, they're mature men now. They've seen some things. They think they have a better perspective, a better understanding of the world, a better understanding of their place in it. You know, when we get these guys, they're in their mid-20s. I mean, they're stars. They get the star treatment everywhere they go. It's really hard to be, you know, balanced and have perspective in that environment. But these guys now, and even talking to Daniel and Henrik now, they were always that way, but I think they're even more so now. They're able to, you know, reflect on their years here. What went right? What went wrong? Why did it go right? Why did it go wrong? And and that's another part of it. I've kind of done similar books like that, looking back at periods in hockey history and getting guys to talk about it 10, 20 years after the fact is a lot easier than it is in the heat of the battle.
Yeah, as I said a moment ago, I'm a casual hockey fan. I mean, I read it in the paper the next day. Mm-hmm. I have found over the last couple of years, listening to like Spitting Chicklets, for example.
Yeah.
I find the interviews with players who are playing now so much more insightful than the interviews that I see on the news or something like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's for people who don't know, that it's a website run by former player Paul Bissonnette and
Ryan Whitney.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Ryan Whitney. And I'm sorry, hockey players talk differently to other hockey players than they do to the media. That's just the way it is. And Bissonnette, he's kind of established himself as a place where players will go to talk, and he gives them free rein. And there's kind of a trust factor there, and he does. He gets some really good stuff. It rubs me a little the wrong way as an old newspaper guy. And the media landscape has changed so much in the last 10 years. And it's just not what it was. It's like herd mentality. It's impossible, virtually impossible, to have meaningful. It still exists, but it is so rare to have meaningful conversations. But, you know, I like to think I'm not fooling myself. I wasn't friends with these guys, but I think I developed a working relationship with a lot of them, where there was a bit of mutual trust there. I think that was the same way for a lot of writers of my era, and I just don't think that exists anymore.
You remind us in the book about the Sedins, that they weren't always seen as the greats that they became. I mean, in 2008, when Mike Gillis takes over, he says at press conference that, you know, these are two solid second-line players, but they weren't elite.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 2008, And then, you know, a couple of years later, you know, things change. What happens in terms of the development of a player and when it strikes, say, and when they become hot? And is that something that you can see happen or can predict even?
That's the extraordinary part about the Sedin story, and you have to take it in its totality. What they were when they were drafted, what they were when they first arrived with the Canucks, their first 3 years, then the lockout season, and it really, it's all credit to them. They just put in the work in conditioning and strength and their off-ice training regimen. This was also a bit of a revelation to me. Like, I knew when they went to Sweden, it was like, you know, basically going back to a boot camp, and they just worked their asses off all summer. But there's a dude named Bert Emanuelsson who coached them in the Swedish underage system. But he was regarded as a bit of a training savant. And this is the early aughts, and he's the stuff that's kind of mainstream now, one-legged core strength, balancing stuff, plyometrics, all that stuff. He was practicing, and he was the one who really put the roadmap together for the Sedins, and then they put in the work. And they did. Their training regimen was grueling, but it paid dividends. And the one I remember is them coming back after the lockout season in 2004-05, because that was it. Oh, the 2003-04, they kind of, well, you know, maybe at best they'll be second line players. Maybe that's the, and then they take this leap, coming back from the coming out of the lockout where they've had two summers of training with Emanuelsson. They take one step. And then after that famous Gillis press conference, 2008-09, they take the next step. And they become superstars in the league and Hart Trophy caliber players. And it's nothing but you know, obviously they have this innate hockey sense that's almost years in its nature. But what allowed them to work that hockey sense was getting their conditioning and their strength up to a level where they could fend off the checks, where they could play longer shifts in the offensive zone, where they could take the pounding. Like I said, full credit to them, and you know, I think that's what makes their ultimate success such an enriching story for Vancouver, right, to the way they went about their business.
Indeed. You take us to 2011 and the Stanley Cup final run there. Another great what-if in the book is it had Manny Malhotra worn a visor and didn't end up injured. How different would that Stanley Cup final have been?
Oh, it is. I Lawrence Gilman, who's the assistant general manager of the team, and said, you know, if Manny Malhotra doesn't get hurt, we win the Stanley Cup. And then the way that team was structured, that was huge. But it wasn't just that. It was just this kind of series of dominoes that started to fall. That was the first one. But then, you know, it was one kind of one thing after another. You know, they get by Chicago with the great goal, but then in the Nashville series they use Samuelsson, who's a really important player for them, kind of plays a second line role, but he moves up and down the lineup and very, very reliable, trusted by the coaches. That's the next one. In the last game against San Jose, Ryan Kessler in the Western Conference Final against San Jose, Ryan Kessler tears his labrum. He'd been the best player in the world for about a month there, and he was a ghost of himself in the Boston series. And then against Boston, second game, Dan Hamhuis goes to hip check Milan Lucic, and he's done for the series too. So it's just like I said, you know, that team was built on depth. Mm-hmm. And they could play the game so fast, and it was just kind of eradicated over time. And then there's the whole Aaron Rome thing, which is almost a separate discussion entirely, but that was part of the story too.
Talking about this last season, as you do in the last part of the book, I was just thinking back to how it was covered in the media. And, you know, I think of guys like Zadorov, Garland, Cole. You know, they were great interviews for the press. Do you think that as much as their play made them fan favorites, say?
I think so. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not the most objective source on that, but I really think the media is the conduit to the fans, and you know, I just, you know, the players who have been, you know, like approachable, who, you know, spoken honestly, who didn't treat in cliches, who didn't, you know, treat the media like there was something to be, you know, like scrubbed off the bottom of their feet. I think that resonates with fans, and I can think of so many examples during my writing days. I'm not talking about, you know, players that were, you know, turned into Shakespeare when you talk to them, but they just gave honest answers. And I think one of the best examples is Wayne Gretzky. I mean, rarely said anything controversial or anything, you know, that made you, you know, stop and give pause. But he was always available. He was always the answer things to the best of his ability, and that's really all you can ask for from a player. But I think that really helped shape Wayne's public image, is that, you know, he would stand up, he would face the music, and he did it throughout his career.
Yeah, look at you picked an image for the cover of the book that says a lot about where this team is today. You know, it's Quinn Hughes and JT Miller. I think of Miller, for example, who has not always been a fan favorite. Someone who appears with the press regularly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his play has improved over the last couple of seasons, but I think that has had something to do with how the public has perceived him. I mean, if they traded him 2 years ago, he probably wouldn't have been missed in this town.
Yeah, but no, and they came very close.
I mean,
it was that off season. The presumption was he would be traded, and the Canucks didn't like the offers they were getting, and then there's a contractual thing that developed with Bo Horvat. And he got off to that amazing start. I can't remember. It's something like along the lines of 30 goals after 40 games. And I put him in a different price bracket, so he's the one who moves. And really, Miller becomes the bell cow for the team. He's the engine that drives the team. And, you know, full credit to him. He's, you know, he came here as kind of a reputation as somebody who's like maybe a little lazy, maybe a bit of a malcontent. And, you know, he had good seasons here, but he's just developed into a different kind of player, that kind of like leader, the team's conscience that every good team needs. And he seems to be that guy. And I'm just wondering if he can like pull a lot of Stetson along in his draft, because that really, I think, is going to determine where this Canucks team, this iteration of the Canucks team's lands. If Patterson really is like one of the eight best centers in the NHL, if he's like a legitimately that guy who can drive a team by himself, then everything changes for this version of the Canucks.
You know, you talk about coaches and the current coach, Rick Tocchet. In relation to how Miller has evolved over the last couple of seasons, does Tocchet play a big part in that?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, to me, I still look at Alain Vigneault's first year with the Canucks when he takes a team that has Roberto Luongo. The Twins are just starting to step out, but they don't have a lot else, and he gets, I think it's 101 points out of them, and they win a playoff series. I still think, given what he has to work with, that's the best coaching job in Canucks history. Tocchet would be a very close second. You know, what he did with that franchise was, and you have to remember how chaotic the year before was.
Mm.
The whole Bruce Boudreau soap opera, and, you know, he steps in and he establishes an identity of the way they're going to play every night, and his fingerprints are all over that team. Andre Kuzmenko goes from a guy who scores almost 40 goals 1 year to a guy who can't get up because he can't play in Tocchet's system. And he's unloaded, and they go on. But I think one of the most overrated things in hockey is getting an underperforming team to overachieve in the short term. But to do it year after year after year and to really build something of substance, that's a whole different game, and I'm going to be really curious to see if Tocchet can keep it up. But full credit to him for last year. It's a, to me, he's the MVP of the team.
Yeah. You do a number of interviews for this book. If you had a chance to speak to somebody who's no longer with us, who would you want to talk to?
Wow, what a great question. I would probably, you know, I had a good relationship with Pat Quinn, so we had a lot of good talks. I used to go to Vancouver Giants games and sit in the box with him and Ron Torrigo, and we'd talk. So I wouldn't say that. You know, maybe somebody like Jake Milford, just because, like, his era was, I didn't know him. I just know the stories. I just kind of really underrated general manager in Canucks history. He's the guy who really puts the 82 team together. So I would like to talk to him just to find out what he's all about, because he was kind of this career hockey guy, toiled in the minors, toiled in junior, and then he kind of gets a hold of the Canucks, and, you know, he has this one draft where his first three or four picks, and I'm just going on memory here, it's Bill DeLago, Curt Fraser, and Stan Smeal, and then he signs Thomas Gradin. He flips the second round into Chicago. He signs Thomas Gradin. So that would be one guy that for sure I'd like to talk to.
He's got one of the better quotes in the book about the draft and how happy he is that, I guess, the week of the draft. And then by the fall, he's not so happy. I'm screwing up the quote, but
that's about it. But again, that's one of the reasons why I'd like to talk to him, because it struck me he was a guy with a pretty good sense of humor and self-effacing. Not a lot of ego there. Just when I was rambling on there. And I'd like to talk to Roger Nielsen again. He was active when I was covering the league, but I'd like to get his perspective on that 82 team.
So I mentioned the cover image on the book of Hughes and Miller. That says a lot about where the team is now. You alluded to this early in our chat, Ed, about how a year ago there were obviously high expectations for the team going into the season. I don't think many people would have predicted where it had ended up. Mm-hmm. What does it look like today at the end of September, just as the season's about to start? I mean, people can see Stanley Cups in their eyes, but, I mean, what's your sense about where the team's headed?
Yeah, I mean, if I were going to offer my honest assessment, I think they're a middle to upper middle team in the NHL. I still look at the teams in the West. I don't think they're as good as Edmonton. I don't think they're as good as Dallas. I think they've really closed the ground with Los. Or I don't think they're as good as Colorado, just to pick up on that point. I think they've really closed ground on Las Vegas to the point where they're very close. Now, the other thing with the Canucks is Thatcher Demko's health is just a massive issue for this team. They have to have elite goaltending, and it looked like they had the team. When Demko's right, he's one of the five best goalies in the NHL, but there's kind of this mystery about what his injury is. And he has proven to be injury-prone over the years. Him and Arthur Shelov, on paper, look to be a tremendous tandem, but I don't think he can go into the season expecting Shelov to play 55 games in his first exposure as an NHL starter for an elite team. So that's a big issue. But, you know, that, obviously they have some really nice pieces in place. I'm really going to be curious about Jonathan Lekkomäki, the first rounder from a year ago, because he has the look of the guy who could be a big-time scorer. And if he's that, if he can, like, find a place there playing with Pettersson and just blanking out on the guy they got from Boston.
DeBrusk,
yeah. Jake DeBrusk. I mean, that gives the Canucks two formidable lines.
Yeah. Do you miss going to training camp or going to games every night? Do you miss that part of it?
To be brutally honest, not really. I mean, I did it for 38 years. There are aspects of it I miss. I miss some of my colleagues. I miss the interchange there. I miss the excitement. I miss the creative process and having to produce under pressure. That's the part I like. But things just got so unrelentingly shitty in the newspaper business here the last 8 years or so, it was hard. It was just like there was this drumbeat of negativity that it was really hard to get out from under, and I just got really tired of seeing, you know, colleagues leave and cutbacks, and everything was being shrunk, and you can put up with it for, and you know, you try and fight the good fight, but you realize you're fighting forces that are bigger than you are, and you have no control over. So I think it was just time for me to step aside. I had a great run. I've got no complaints, so I just soon leave it there.
Who do you like reading today?
That's a good question. It's changed so much. It is like I think Patrick Johnson at our paper does a terrific job covering the game. Kind of, you know, old school reporting. You know, getting stuff out. Steve Simmons is a longtime colleague, and I understand he's polarizing for a lot of people, but that's kind of the job of the columnist, and he still does it, and I have massive respect for him to still be doing it day in, day out, the same way. After that, you know, Jesus, so it's changed so much. And, you know, remember when I was, you'd go into a city and you'd pick up both papers or however many papers that city had, and you sit there and you read them. Well, what does Cam Cole have to say today? Or, you know, if you're in the States, what did? I can't pick a name. It was just I love going to Chicago and getting the Trib and the Sun Times and reading their beat writers and columnists, or going to Boston and reading the Globe. You know, my friend Kevin Paul DuPont is still actually he makes the list for sure. He's still pumping it out, but I mean, geez, there's just some absolute giants writing when I was just started, and it was just a thrill for me to be a part of it.
There was one thing that I just thought about as we were talking, as you're talking about people we read in the sort, you know, Canucks Twitter, the fans on Twitter have taken on, you know, in the last however long we've been using Twitter, you know, to criticizing the people covering the Canucks. You know, I remember what's that press conference a couple seasons ago where Ben Kuzma asked.
About his dad.
Yeah, and then he got a lot of criticism over that. How did you find, as you were working the beat, what it was like having to deal with the criticism on Twitter?
Well, I chose not to for the most part, but it's something else I don't miss about the job. It just, the way the game is covered and the way the fans respond to the way the game is covered changed so much. I have a hard time pinpointing, and it was probably with the advent and the popularity of Twitter. The last 10, 15 years, and so much of the coverage now is either, both from the fans and the media's point of view, is I know more than the general manager, I know more than the team does, here's the mistake they made, and I can prove it through analytics, and then the response from the fans is, you're an idiot, you don't know what you're talking about, that's it. I had this conversation with Ray Ferraro, and it was, like, I just love Ray, and I don't think he'd hold it against me for making this public, because we were actually playing golf. And he said, you know, I don't get it. Like, I played like 1,200 games in the NHL. I've covered over 1,000 games. Like, I think I know what I'm talking about. And it's like I don't go to my kid's school and tell the teacher, you know, you're doing it wrong. Like, I assume they know what they're doing because they're in that position. Why don't they give me the benefit of the doubt here? It was the language was a little more colorful than that.
It was
a great point. It was, you know. You know, there has to be accountability and all that stuff, but this is on a different level now.
And I should just add, when I brought up Kuzma and Besser, that when Besser was ready to talk, he did talk to Ben Kuzma.
Yeah, he did, and it was it was such a raw human moment. We want to get out, and you go about it in a certain way, and he wasn't confrontational about it. As I recall, the phrasing of the question was very polite and open-ended, and gave Brock all kinds of room to answer it the way he wanted to, and he gave this really thoughtful answer, and I think it changed the way people looked at Brock, and it certainly, you know, kind of explained where his production was. And God, I was as thrilled as anybody that he had the season he had last year, because I was You know, I remember when he was drafted and he came up and he was going to be the next great thing for the Canucks when they were a terrible team, and you know, he had to learn, and you know, he had some moments where he looked great and then some moments not so much. But you know, if he really is that 35 to 40 goal scorer, again, that changes a lot of things for the Canucks.
What if he had played that game 7 against Edmonton?
Who knows? Yeah, I mean, who knows? Again, well, I was running out of what ifs at that point. it's conceivable, but I honestly think the right team won that series.
Ed, this is such a great book. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. It wasn't boring at all. It's been great talking to you. I so appreciate your time today. All the best and continued good luck with the book.
Thanks very much, Joe, and thanks for your time. I appreciate the platform. Cheers, man.
The book is called Never Boring, The Up and Down History of the Vancouver Canucks. Its author, Ed Willis, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.